Okay, internet, I think it's live. I'm getting more and more confident every time we do this that I'm capable of clicking the correct button. This is Michael Burns. We have a very special guest on today's stream. I would say, and you know, I'm saying this, and he's in the room, is going to be on the screen in a second. But I'm here with Matt from Mr. Beat. I would say one of the top tier, you know, educational adjacent YouTubers. And I feel like there's a thing with saying like educational YouTubers that it has a ring of, I don't know, like that education isn't cool. I think education is cool. I'm a former educator. I make educational stuff, but really top tier. One of the people that makes it really, really fun. So excited to have him here in chat today. If you're here, guys, like the thing, jump in the chat. Let's hang out and have some fun. Once we get going, we can definitely, I'll take some time to make sure if you guys have questions, we could ask them. A quick moment of self-promotion. I put out a video on depression and mental health and capitalism and neuroscience the other day. If you want to watch it, I would suggest watching it. Put some work into it. I think it turned out okay. But enough about me. I'm going to bring... Is it okay if I call you Matt on? Is that allowed?
Yeah, you can call me Matt. It's fine.
Okay, I want to be respectful. I don't know if Mr. Beast is the preferred nomenclature in all context.
Only for my students. So
okay,
which I really don't have anymore.
yeah. Well, let me start with that then. So I, you know, it's always interesting talking to someone for the first time whose videos I've watched for years and who I parasocially feel like I know a lot of stuff about. But just as someone myself who also like used to work in education, I'm kind of curious if you could talk a little bit about kind of your background in education, what led you to being an educator and that sort of stuff before I maybe ask you some questions about how you went from classroom guy to internet guy.
It's so weird because I have a parasocial relationship with you as well. I've watched your videos for a while.
There we go.
With Wisecrack. And yeah, I'm glad you're doing your own thing now. That's really cool. But yeah, this is the first time we've officially met, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to give a little bit about my background, I was a classroom teacher for about 12 years. I taught social studies to seventh graders, eighth graders, all the way up to 12th grade, government, American history, world history, economics, you name it. And I made videos at the same time. My previous career was I was in TV and radio. So my first degree was in journalism. That was my, like I was going to be a media dude. Actually, I wanted to originally be a music journalist, but then decided I kind of had a quarter life crisis and went back to school to become a teacher. And anyway, yeah, so I just made videos for my students for fun. This is before you could make money from YouTube.
Yeah.
So I just did it for fun. And then at some point, I began making money from it, and other teachers were playing my videos to their students. And then once I realized that people were just watching my videos for fun, like just learning for fun, I was like, maybe I should take this more seriously. And then I did. So I've been doing this full time now for about 4 years. So I'm always ready to go back to the classroom if this doesn't work out.
Yeah. Well, was that a tough decision when you were making stuff and still in the classroom? Like, what was the process that went into that? And I know as well, I feel like this is something that comes up in your video, so I'm not speaking out of class here, but I know you have a family and stuff as well, and I know that having to think about financial stuff when we have kids and partners is important. So what was that decision making process like to go from something that at least feels, even though it's not as much as it should be, feels relatively stable, like working in education, to doing YouTube stuff? Like, what was that process like for you?
I love how you just framed that. Yeah, feels stable. That was kind of the wake up call I had. This was during the pandemic when I mm-hmm. just crunched the numbers and I was like, I'm making a lot more money now than I do in the classroom. This is so mm-hmm. messed up, but also kind of cool. So I at first, of course, had to convince my partner, my wife, and she was a little bit skeptical at first. And I mean, you know, the main thing is you got to worry about benefits going away.
Yeah,
you
of course.
Pay for health insurance yourself here in the United States of America, this great country, mm-hmm. Where you get to spend tens of thousands of dollars just on premiums. So before you even get any benefits from the insurance companies. So yeah, like that was a huge consideration. I do have a family. I have two kids. We talked a lot about it, but I mean, it was a little scary right when I did go full time in 2021. Like my first two videos just completely flopped. So it was it was horrible. I'm sure you're kind of going through a transition now too, aren't you?
I am. Yeah. I'm 1 month into not having a job, traditionally speaking. A little different because I was, you know, making YouTube stuff, but in the context of, you know, an established channel that was owned by a media company and kind of had its own thing. And, you know, the thing in that context, which, you know, I'm learning now was quite a luxury, was like if we, it wisecrack, like if we had the best month ever or the worst month ever, the paycheck was the same amount.
Yes.
And I had healthcare benefits and stuff like that. So definitely, it's such a weird transition because I've looked at YouTube analytics in a professional context for, you know, like a few years because I've spent about 4 or 5 years full time at Wisecrack. But the emotional difference of looking at YouTube analytics in that context and doing it now as I at least try to make that my job is really jarring.
Yeah, it's a roller coaster. I mean, yeah. You might have a couple of good months where you're just like, heck yeah, man, I'm not even going to retire at the age of 75.
Yeah.
And then other months you're just like, I'm going to have to go be a barista again at a coffee shop because I used to do that as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the thing is, when I started making the videos and making money from it, at first I just was like, oh, this is going to be a side hustle the rest of my life. Because my side hustle before that was I coached tennis and I coached basketball.
Oh, and hell yeah.
It was just a way to be home more. And I think that's the best part about it is I can work from home and I can go to my kids' school if I need to. But yeah, it's, I just never take it for granted, I guess. I'm sure you don't either.
No. But that it's also interesting to know that background that before you were an educator, you were doing like, you know, TV and radio stuff. And I know you're a music guy as well. Because that makes sense of why your videos are the way they are and why you kind of why I guess there was like sort of a natural kind of transition there. I wondered to jump ahead a little bit. Unless there's an upload between this one, so apologies if I mess up here. But your most recent video, I think, and the last one I watched was the one on sort of short one on education and AI.
Oh, that yeah.
I think came in wake of the New York Magazine article, which I read and talked about on a stream last week as well. I think that article blew up in general, but definitely anyone who was in the classroom or has been in the classroom. And I'd kind of been thinking about this stuff because a week or two ago, caught up with an old friend who was a colleague when I worked in education as well. And I've been out of the classroom for, I guess, close to 10 years. And he was kind of just saying to me, like, it's totally different. Like even in the time since you were in the classroom, like it's totally different now. It's so much harder to get him to read. And the AI thing is so real. And, you know, I believed him listening to him, but reading that article was pretty shocking. And, you know, watching your video about it, you really have a big gotcha moment at the end. I mean, I don't want to spoil it, folks. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. But when you reveal that the last chunk of your video was written by AI, but I don't know. I know you have a video about this, but what is it like for you as someone who is still an educator, just not in a classroom context, hearing about all the changes that are happening and how technology is affecting students and their ability to learn?
Well, first of all, you were a teacher as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. I taught a philosophy broadly construed at colleges for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Like all my philosophy education, I think, comes from you these days. But yeah, like I do keep in regular contact with my former colleagues. I was just back actually for a retirement reception for two of them. And I told both of them, you're getting out at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is really kind of, I don't think enough teachers realize how dramatic this change is. And one thing about teaching is, I mean, you know, it's one of the most difficult professions, and especially those first couple of years you're starting out and you're just like drowning and you're just trying to reach the surface. You lean heavily on your other more veteran teachers.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, veteran teachers just are irrelevant anymore. And I know that sounds horrible, but like
yeah.
They are fossils. trained for a system that no longer exists. And so I feel like young teachers do have the advantage, at least. For starters, a lot of them have probably already used AI maybe to cheat themselves through college.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm not a doomsdayer. Like, I know I used AI to come up with solutions at the end of my video, but some of those solutions I think legit I've thought about before, I think are a good way forward.
They weren't all bad.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's just basically, you just have to completely go back to paper and pencil, basically. I mean, we do the same thing now for elementary school kids with math. It's not like we're just like a second grader who's learning addition, subtraction. We're just like, hey, here's a computer or a very fancy calculator, get to work. No, we're like, they're working it out first. And then later on, just to make sure the process is quicker. So I think it's the same thing. As long as they learn how to write and learn how to critically think through writing at a young age, then by the time they do get to high school, college, yeah, that's fine. They can use AI in certain circumstances. That's the way I see it.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about this in the context of, you know, I guess like armchair quarterbacking education now that I'm not on the field, so to speak, anymore. But yeah, it feels like you kind of got to go back to go forward. And I taught in the UK for a while. And in UK universities, you know, they have like the kind of seminar model where in a lot of courses, like, you know, all the students, you know, might be like 50, 60, 80, go to one lecture a week. And then at another point in the week, smaller groups have seminars. And when I was in graduate school, you know, the grad students would teach the seminars, and it would be like 10 students. We'd sit, you know, in a circle or like a square table thing. And a lot of it would literally just be like reading a text together and talking about it. So like, you know, reading like one of Plato's dialogues, and I'd read a little bit and we'd kind of talk about it and shoot the shit. And, you know, some weeks it'd be like pulling teeth to get them to talk. Other weeks something would be said and it would inspire students and they would talk about it. And then for exams in that system, it was always like in a room with a book where they had to write stuff. It made grading kind of intense sometimes, but I don't know. I think a model like that is probably, at least in the humanities, I don't want to speak to what science and math education is like, but it seems like you kind of got to do that. Like find, and I know that's hard in a system where I know for a lot of teachers, more and more students are being shoved in their classes at all times. But I feel like we need to get back to something where it involves a lot more like reading collectively, talking about ideas as much as we can, and then just like having them write stuff down. And maybe another model, in my last year of teaching, I, for the first time, did a thing where I gave students the option, if they didn't want to do the final paper, they could do a presentation.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, I guess I was just thinking in terms of, you know, social media and kids that make stuff, like maybe for some people making like literally like a YouTube style video or doing a PowerPoint thing works better for their brain in terms of how to express stuff. So I don't know, maybe there's ways where we can lean into that side of things to give students an opportunity, to show that they're learning.
I mean, there's two purposes for writing as far as I could tell. Correct me if you think there's additional, but the first purpose of writing is like, it's basically a form of expression that can be an art, but it also can be like just a utility, like a way to communicate that is most effective. And then the other purpose of writing is writing to learn. And that's why I used to have my students actually write stuff out on paper when they took notes, never typing notes, because there had been numerous studies that had shown that if you write it out, you're much more likely to remember it. And so, yeah, like it's a little bits like that. I think a lot of teachers actually do already have the right tools to tackle AI. In fact, you mentioned with the English schools that you were at, where I student taught in Omaha, Nebraska, the West Side School District, the West Side High School, they do that. They have a lecture once a week, and then they have the little small group seminars. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Let's see. Sorry, I had a list of stuff on there. Okay, so I'm going to bounce around a bit, but we can hopefully I don't overwhelm you with questions here. But one thing I'm thinking about, so one of the things I think people think of you as is like the history guy, like in terms of like American history in particular. If someone is loading up YouTube and they're like, where do I go? I feel like you are one of the main guys for that, if not the main guy. And I get the sense these days that we're in a kind of peculiar point in terms of what people want from history, whereas there's been a sense for, I don't know, people my age for most of our lives, like history is good because it gives us a way to understand what is possible, what has happened, and how what has happened can help us understand what is happening. And it seems like in American political life right now, at least it feels like we're coming up against this thing where maybe we're at a point where what's happening is so new or weird that we lose that connection to historical precedent, or that maybe like this is the instance where we can't use whatever historical precedency to understand the Trump administration, or we can't use, you know, economic history to understand the current tariff situation or to understand the influence of the tech industry in Washington or whatever it might be. So as a history person, I wonder what you say to that kind of feeling right now.
Yeah, well, I do try to specialize in American political history. Mm-hmm. So like, don't get it twisted. When it comes to anything other than that, I don't know much about it. Yeah, but I appreciate the kind words and like, wow, history guy. But yeah, American political history. And yeah, this is a story, like the story of American political history from 1776 through the present. I've read it 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a story I'm actually, it makes me feel good because I know for the most part, we made progress and we had some bumps in the road, the Civil War. Sure. That was a pretty big bump. But you know, ultimately we progressed as a society. The problem now is this is a different chapter that it doesn't fit into the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. Like this is a chapter that actually is probably more appropriate for maybe Italian history or German history. We're like, oh, we have not experienced this before. Yeah. Where you have, I mean, it doesn't matter what the society is. You have a certain percentage of the folks who are like, they're going to fall for demagogues, and they also don't mind dictators or fascism or just authoritarianism in general. I guess I was naive to think that, you know, reading this story 1,000 times, just knowing like to our core, these last 250 years, Americans have really valued individualism. Like that has been the thing. And I know like a lot of people now are having hot takes like, oh, we're actually not that individualistic. I don't know. I kind of disagree with that. Like, I think that's what makes us truly uniquely American is that individuality. And when you're seeing a chapter now that just totally goes against that, yeah, I'm just like, what the heck, man? What am I? And that's why also I've been speaking out a lot more about current events. And most people are just like, stick to history. Like, well, dude, like, I think we're living through pretty historic times. And I've learned a few things at this point. I'm 43 years old. I feel like maybe I should start sharing like what I've learned, you know?
Yeah, I've like felt that externally in your content that I think for a while, and I mean, what I'm about to say, I mean this in a very positive way. I think that like, there is, of course, a tendency more than ever, and especially on YouTube, that everything is very like polarized and camp based. Like, and I think that in a lot of ways, you know, your work does a really good job of appealing beyond that and not coming across as overly ideological. And I think while maintaining that, it does feel like in the last year or so, in some of your videos, you are speaking out a bit more, or it seems like you're just like, and like you say, as someone who like knows the American story and seems to love and appreciate that history, it from an external perspective feels like there's part of you that comes out in your videos that's like, come on guys, like we're better than this, we could do better than this, there's a rich history there, what are we doing?
Because this I always felt like it was pretty easy for me to be not just bipartisan but nonpartisan, because there are just a certain set of values that pretty much every American you think just all agrees on, you know, like I always say the word freedom, you say the word freedom, doesn't matter where you lean politically in the United States, or everyone's like, yeah, freedom. I mean, okay. But it means different things to different people. Obviously there's freedom from, freedom to, yada, yada. But I just feel like now, like there's a group of people that are like, no, they're okay with giving up a lot of freedom.
Yeah. Well, then I wonder, so another, you know, sort of lane I see you in is you're someone who and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I don't want to mischaracterize you, is a libertarian, or sort of espouses a certain libertarian ideology. And I think, and I know some you've referenced before, but like when I, and we're around the same age. So when I think of libertarian, the point of my life where that became an idea I knew about was Ron Paul. And one of the early like Ron Paul elections, it was a time where I learned like, oh, that's what like libertarianism is. And there was a lot of, I felt like when I was, you know, cause when was the Ron Paul campaign that got a lot of traction? Was that like 2008? Okay. And you know, I remember at that point of time, there being overlap in friends I had of people that I would characterize as left leaning or at least progressive, and folks who were excited about the Paul campaign. People that were maybe, you know, sort of like, yeah, I want everyone to have a good life. I don't think people should go to jail for smoking weed or whatever. And also I think this guy's economic policies I like, yada, yada. I feel like, and again, external perspective here, libertarianism in recent times has turned into something different. And I'll give you an example here is at my old job, we did a video where I did this online course from Hillsdale College that was on Marxism and socialism or something like that. And, you know, I knew it was going to be very ideologically coded one way. But the thing I was kind of surprised about was that everything in this course kind of landed on a certain idea of liberty or libertarianism that was really attached or really pointed towards, for lack of a better term, like Trumpism or, you know, where we're at now. So what is it like to be, I guess, like a libertarian in that classical model, in that, you know, someone who came up with Ron Paul, who is now in a world where, like, you know, like the PragerU crowd, a lot of those people think they are libertarian. A lot of people on the far right who are espousing things, so I think you probably don't like, are libertarian. What has it been like for you? Sorry, that's a convoluted way to ask that.
No, yeah, that's a great question. I think the argument or the confusion is just about the path to get to freedom. Mm-hmm. And so those so-called Trumpist libertarians, you know, which, yeah, I mean, many of them are out there. Many of them, like Dave Smith is a comedian who famously, like, you talk trash about Trump for years and all of a sudden it's like, yeah, actually, Trump is the most libertarian choice. But yeah, like, it's such a word that doesn't really mean much anymore, just like socialism, just like communism, just like, I mean, so that's another problem. It's weaponized, it's meaningless. But I say, like, for me, I don't even label myself anything. I think labels don't really are counterproductive most of the time. And so, but I will say, as I've gotten older, I definitely have moved further and further to the left. And I think it's that doesn't mean I can't be like pro-liberty and the classical libertarian sense. So I think the difference between me and someone who supports Trump is, they think that we need a strong man to apparently give certain people freedoms, liberty. Whereas I always valued civil liberties were my big thing. And like, even when a lot of people that lean to the left will say, oh, we need stricter gun control. Like right now, I'm hoping many people that lean to the left realize the Second Amendment is there for also you. Like, because we have somebody who wants to be an authoritarian. So this is like the last leverage we have to an authoritarian state. So I think that because it means so many different things to different people, that's where the confusion and I mean, you could debate this crap for hours and get nowhere, right?
Well, I wonder then, and I do want to give a shout out and a hi. There's some people in the chat who I think are from your Twitch world. So I want to say hi to those people. Hello, Mr. B, Twitchers, glad to see you here.
Subscribe.
Yeah, subscribe. Do it.
Michael.
Oh, and if you're here and you're not subscribed to everyone's subscribed to everything. But one thing I was thinking about when you described maybe not wanting the definition, right, is the idea, and I've thought about this recently as well, is getting back to describing one's core political principles rather than the brand ideology. Because like you said, like you could say, I'm a libertarian. And Dennis Prager could say, I'm a libertarian. And from an external perspective, one might be like, oh, they mean they're the same guy. But when you describe what that means for you, and if Dennis Prager describes what that means for him, it might be wildly different. Whereas, and I find this as someone who, you know, I loosely describe myself as a form of socialist. And sometimes with my lovely Midwestern aunts and uncles, they'll be like, Mikey, don't put me in a gulag. And then I'll often say, oh, no, when I say that, here's what I mean. And more often than not, it's like, oh, okay. Like when you boil something down to a set of principles, it often feels more reasonable for folks. So yeah, yep. Is that something you have found value in, like thinking of things in terms of these are my like values or political principles rather than this is the brand I represent?
Yeah. Every issue, it's an issue by issue thing, and it's always a spectrum. And you always say, okay, if you're going to talk about guns, like, you could be on one end of the spectrum where you say no restrictions on guns in any circumstance whatsoever. On the other end, you get rid of the guns. Yeah. So I say the vast majority of people are somewhere in between on nearly every issue. They're somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, which makes pretty much everyone a centrist. All of us are boring centrists. It's, and I know we don't like to hear it, but.
I mean, the gun thing is interesting because I think that's become a sort of liberal talking point or pearl clutching thing where like a certain chunk of American liberals have decided unequivocally all guns, all bad, all the time, forever. And then, you know, that gets complicated when you think of the history of very progressive groups like the Black Panthers, who for them, yes. Second Amendment rights meant the ability to defend their community from the encroachment of folks. And there's a lot of, you know, communities of color and left-leaning communities who are like, you know, I know people have like socialist gun clubs and stuff who, for the same reason you said, like if the totalitarian fascist types are arming up, then maybe there's value in recognizing that the Second Amendment works both ways.
Absolutely.
You know, but that's where I am a soft liberal. Not that I don't think the Second Amendment is good. Guns are just, you know, scary. I shot one at a bachelor party once and it kicked back way too much. And I felt like a real beta. I've never felt like less of an alpha than when shooting a gun at a bachelor party.
But to me though, like a gun is like the most beta thing possible. Like you need a gun to defend yourself. Like, come on, what about this gun? Huh? You know, like,
yeah, yeah. That's I'm with you there. That's really good. What has it been like then for you as a, you know, a person that makes stuff on the internet? And I feel like one of your recent videos got to this. What was the video where you're sitting outside at the top of the steps? I think of your videos visually sometimes because you're often in different places, which I find really fun. And it was the video where you had the sociology professor on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like in that one you started by showing some comments that were basically implying that recently people have sort of like forcefully politicized your content or like shoved you through those lenses. Has that been a more recent thing for you?
Oh, yeah. Like, well, since 2020, I guess. Okay. But yeah. I mean, yeah, it's, I still get a lot of criticism from folks that lean to the left. And so people just assume, oh, like, no, it's all Trump supporters that attack me. No, like, and I think the main problem, of course, in the video, I lay out the four main reasons why I think we're so divided. And you've actually, I think actually in one of your videos, maybe it was Wisecrack, but you hit on similar points. I mean, we always like to just blame echo chambers and social media bubbles. But that's only part of the picture. I do think that, it's been because, I guess I don't want to get too much into it, but, I think we don't look at socioeconomics enough. Mm-hmm. Like the bottom line is, yeah, like overall, I think we have a higher standard of living, in the world than we've ever had before. But I think, the whole bread and circuses thing, like, distractions are a problem, but hey, we still have our bread too. We actually don't. Like, I think there's this, like, that's the thing. Like, I think the reason why we think everyone's okay economically is just because they're not really looking at it closely enough. I mean, we're all in debt. Almost all of us are in debt. if you're under the age of 40, you're probably not going to own a home. The wealth disparity is worse now than it was during the Gilded Age, which I've been reading a lot about the Gilded Age again, just to kind of like, oh yeah, this is what we're living through. And I think that's really at the root of most of our division in society.
Yeah. And I think people feel that. Like there was I watched a little bit of the Majority Report the other day when Sam Cedar was talking to Ezra Klein about the abundance book and some of the stuff about housing policy. And there was a really good kind of response video to that by R.M. Brown. And
R.M. Brown, I love R.M. He's great. That's great.
That makes sense to me that we both like that guy. The more I learn about you, we have a lot of stuff in common. But yeah, R.M. Brown's like my favorite YouTube channel. But there's a thing that RM got into in the video is like, you know, Ezra Klein was using some like reading statistics in such a way of being like, oh, actually housing in Austin is getting cheaper. But then RM was showing a bunch of data that was like, well, actually people are paying more of their rent than ever on housing. So like the average Austin resident is, you know, paying through the gills, paying half of their income just to do that. And especially low income housing is becoming more expensive and no one can buy housing anymore. So I think it's a weird era where there's, and I think people felt this in the last election, this isn't a new point, where people were told by some like, oh, actually things are going great. And then they looked around at themselves in their communities and they're like, are they though? Is it like in another town where everyone has like good jobs and is buying houses and just not here or something? Cause I'm not experiencing that.
And there's certain economic indicators that the elites, whatever that means, but you know what I mean? Like they look at GDP or they look at the stock market. It's still going up, but I think the more important economic indicators are stuff like the happiness index or social mobility, stuff like that should be looked at.
Well, and I think the video that you referenced before that I made over at the other place, and people got really mad. I think this is the video that I've been a part of the last couple of years. People got the most mad at. The gist of it was that like a lot of the left right infighting stuff misses the larger point. And maybe we spend too much time focusing on like how mad we are at our uncle's Facebook post about politics or whatever than we are about larger socioeconomic conditions and about how a lot of those things affect more of us and unify us. And you know, there's a lot of comments that I remember on that one were sort of like accusing me and the team there of being too soft and going easy on like fashion. And it's a thing I've talked about other places too, but I just think at the end of the day, like, I don't know if that's what's going to get us. And I don't think I go as far, and I forget the name of the professor who was in your video that I referenced. I think it was at University of Pennsylvania.
Social
119.
It's a weird number. It's not. Social 119.
Okay. Yeah.
Dr. Richards.
Yeah. No, but I definitely like, I don't think I go as far, or I'm uncomfortable with going as far as he seems to be willing to go. I'm like, oh, we're all kind of the same. People mostly agree. Like I still kind of struggle with that. Although as I say that, maybe I don't agree with what I'm just saying. Cause I guess maybe what I think is like, this is the thing about me. I'm always going to admit that I'm wrong. But I guess like my gut instinct is, I don't know. It seems like we do have a lot of differences, but then my second thought is, or maybe we do share the same values, but our fears and anxieties are the things that are driving us to like blame people for why we don't have what we have maybe.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, we all agree that certain things are good and certain things are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, this is a broad brush, but who should we blame? What are the specific solutions? That's where there's disagreements. And a lot of times those solutions and disagreements or scapegoats are, you know, it's oversimplified so much. And scapegoating in general is really bad because, you know, blaming something on an entire group of people is ridiculous. And but that said, you notice how it's really difficult to get everyone on the same page scapegoating billionaires. It seems like there's only left-leaning people that scapegoat billionaires. And that's really fascinating to me because you think it'd be pretty obvious at this point, you know, there's what, just a few thousand people that have everything. And there are hundreds of millions of other people that mm-hmm. don't have much. And so you think that all the hundreds of millions of people would just all get together and like, okay, well, just look at those few thousand people over there. Maybe they're the ones causing all the problems, but it hasn't happened. So that to me just shows you that, oh yeah, it's the media age we live in. It's people, it's so easy to manipulate.
And that is
people.
Like the most confusing, I think the most confusing part of looking at the situation, like you just described, is why is it the case that a lot of poor and working people in America find more solidarity with eccentric billionaires that have nothing in common with them than they do with other, you know, working or middle-class people? Even thinking about like recently I got to briefly talk to a librarian who's having a tough time being kind of under attack in their community. And it's one of those things where it's like, those people have a lot more in common with a working class librarian than they do with the billionaires that are telling them that the librarian is bad or that books are evil. So that's, I think, a thing for a lot of us. We're like very confused or thrown off by. And on the flip side, I think the question or the task of a lot of people, and I think it's something that I'm sure to various extents you and I think about in the work that we do, is like, okay, well, then how do you communicate with people like that in a way that's, you know, not patronizing, but that helps people understand that, like, no, the librarian isn't the bad guy?
That's a really difficult challenge. That's we've all been trying to figure it out for so long. And I think the lessons I've learned so far, for sure, are you do not make fun of these folks who fall for demagogues. For one, I used to be that person not that long ago. We all fall for con artists to a certain extent. And I think as long as we focus on you've been lied to instead of you're an idiot, then yeah. I think that's a huge step. And then after that, though, I mean, getting a diverse group of people all on the same page, I think it's most easiest if you always bring up class versus anything else. Like, because, again, I'm starting to sound like a broken record here, but if everybody doesn't have much, hey, actually, we have a lot in common. We don't. You're poor too. What a coincidence!
And I was thinking about this question. I made a short video a few months ago on the question of like empathy, because it's something I've been kind of obsessed with. Is how empathy has become in a certain corner of the right wing thought sphere like a bad thing. And there's like weird theologians now who argue that like empathy and compassion are bad. And I said something at the end of that video to the effect of like, hey, fellow lefties, maybe there's a world where like we don't need to post stuff like, well, I'm glad the people that voted for Trump are now suffering economically, or I'm glad these people are getting what they deserved. Because I both understand the schadenfreude of being mad at people who maybe voted for a thing that isn't making your life good. Of course, that sucks. But as I get older, I'm getting softer. I'm trying to push myself to understand that a lot of people, like you just said, have been lied to. And when someone votes against their own self-interest, or when someone aligns politically in a way that is against their self-interest, like they kind of got duped, or they kind of got caught up in some ideological stuff like many of us have. And maybe we should push ourselves within reason to feel some solidarity. You know, I would never ask like a black friend to have like too much empathy or solidarity with someone that thinks they don't have a right to exist because of the color of their skin. Sure. Totally get that.
Yeah.
But there can be that question. I mean, something you said, there was a comment and someone said, which was the radicalization of Bill Burr. And it makes me think of your Joe Rogan video, which I thought was really, really great.
Thanks.
But you know, it's interesting to think about like the American political spectrum via the twin paths of Joe Rogan and Bill Burr, two guys who like, however many years ago, very similar, just like bald guys who yell a lot, both from the Northeast, I think. And now you have, you know, Rogan. And I think one of the things that I loved about your Rogan video was you kind of show this like splitting timeline where it goes from talking to people that he doesn't agree with, being really curious about differing opinions. And I think the Michael Osterholm thing, because to me, that was the point at which I remember watching Rogan's interview with Osterholm in March 2020 and thinking to myself at the time, like, okay, that's really cool. He's talking to this guy. Yes. Osterholm is making me feel safe and good. And for those who don't know, Michael Osterholm, one of the most important like epidemiologists or some, I don't know if I got his title right, but one of the guys in the early pandemic as well, who was like a good science guy who was
like his whole life, literally studying pandemics.
Yeah.
That's what he specializes is pandemics.
But you know, we go from Rogan being someone who has Osterholm on to be like, tell us what's going on, man. Like, help us understand this, to being someone who then has him on later and comes at him with conspiracy theory stuff. And now Joe Rogan being someone who largely has created his own little self-sustaining echo chamber. Whereas Bill Burr, other loud bald man, is someone who just kind of, like you said, seems to be like a class first guy these days in terms of when people bring up politics to him. And I like that he doesn't take himself too seriously. I like that sometimes Bill Burr will even say, like, why the fuck are you asking me? I'm a comedian. Like, you're a journalist. You should do the work. You know, he'll just point out stuff like, there's these billionaires that are making our lives bad. Why aren't we mad at them? Why aren't we mad at that group? So I just like that sort of oversimplification of the current American political moment as like the Joe Rogan, Bill Burr splitting timelines or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird that I got a lot of criticism for that Joe Rogan video saying that I said that RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard still lean to the left.
And oh, then, yeah, you did say that.
It caused me to think about, like, well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I got duped by them because, you know, they used to run that way, but maybe they never were. Maybe, like, when they said that they wanted universal health care, they were lying. So there's another example of me falling for people.
Yeah. I mean, it just
manipulated.
Yeah. And I think, too, sometimes the politicians, it's sort of like, you know, the power versus principles thing. And yeah. I guess that I'm at least soft enough in many ways to think that a lot of people get into it, maybe mostly motivated by principle and kind of aware of power. But then I think that gets corrupted. Like there's a part in and this is a boring, you know, old philosophy professor part of my brain, but there's early on in Plato's Republic, Socrates is talking about the ideal state and he talks about who should rule the state. And he has a line that's basically like, the type of person who would want to rule the state is the last person who should do it.
Yep.
The person who should actually rule the state is the one who would almost have to be compelled by force, because for them, the only reason they would want to lead is because it would be so much worse if someone else did, or because like they were desperate to embody some sort of principle. And I just think that's true. Like this is, you know, this isn't a new idea. And I think then when you see people, you know, and we could say RFK and Tulsi Gabbard, we could say a lot of folks here who, you know, maybe there was a point in which they believed some of the stuff that they said, but the closer and closer they get to power, the more it seems. And I think if like there's anything, when I think of like Trumpism as a thing compared to more, I guess, like classical American conservatism or neoliberalism, it's almost like the complete detachment from the idea that you even have to perform principles, that you even have to like performatively say, I have these values. You can kind of just do whatever you want and chase power. And that's like how the game works now. And in a sense, like, I appreciate that mask off element makes it more real and lets us see the thing for what it is, but it is such a large shift from, and, you know, people in the chat, don't get mad at me when I say what I'm about to say. But, you know, I remember being in high school and arguing with my dad about George Bush and my dad being like, ah, you know, but seems like a guy you could go fishing with or have a beer with or whatever. And there was a truth to that. There was a truth to the sort of like humanity or the performance of a type of humanity. And we just don't have that anymore. I don't think anyone wants to go fishing with Donald Trump. I don't think that guy's probably never been fishing, or maybe he's been deep sea fishing or sat on the boat.
I have no idea. I should know that, but yeah, and it's because of the polarization. It's because they know they can get away with it as long as they have half of the population on their side. Mm-hmm. They can do whatever the heck they want, and that's why a lot of people have been critical of the Democratic Party, because they're still stuck in that old way of, oh, we got to have principles and we got to play by the rules. Like, no, there's the rule book is gone, and now you need somebody in 2028 to run for president who is way further left than Joe Biden was. Otherwise, yeah. That's just where that's the reality. Where you run somebody who's moderate, you're going to have so many people that just don't. They just leave. So many people that lean so far left that are angrier at the Democratic Party than Trump supporters are. And that's something we really need to think about more. Like all the people that are disillusioned from the Democratic Party that have left it in the last 2 years because they're not moving far left enough.
Yeah. And you know what? There's more and more, I think, and even pretty like middle of the road Democrats I've talked to and folks in my family, people are starting to lose their minds about the fact that like, whoa, wait, so we just know now that everyone inside the party was like, this guy's not in a good place to run. He should not be running. He's not, you know, cognizant mentally to do that. But now they're going to still just tell us that that wasn't true, even though we know it was true. So there's an element in which a lot of the same criticisms that people maybe had against Trump, we see against the left. And all people, I think a lot of people just want the Democratic Party to say like, hey, we messed up. We didn't do a good job. We need to do a better job. And it seems very clear that at least at the top, they're not going to do that.
Republicans don't apologize either, though.
That's a good point. But they do it in a more brazen way. That's at least it's almost more impressive. You don't have to say this if you don't want to, if it's going to get you in trouble. Is there anyone when you think about 2028 that you think is an interesting person who could run or someone you think would have a chance? I have takes on this, too, so I'm not going to get you in trouble. I'll talk about this as well. But I wonder if you have thoughts.
Assuming we have a presidential election in 2028. Yeah, of course. No. I only half joke about that. Tim Walz, I did not hide the fact that I'm a fan of that guy. He's a former social studies teacher.
Love that guy.
Former coach. Yeah, he's an old white dude, but he is actually a pretty progressive fella. When we say progressive, like really his views are fairly boring. Like I would say 75% of Americans agree with Tim Walz on nearly every issue. Mm-hmm. That's just how messed up our politics are right now. So yeah, but if, it's got to be somebody who just, the other good thing about Tim Walz is he doesn't, the only reason why he started to become not very cool anymore in the 2024 election cycle was because you could tell he was starting to listen to his consultants, his advisors. I remember when he said he was talking trash about the Electoral College and I was like, heck yeah, there you go. And then all of a sudden, he walked it back. I was like, oh no.
It was so obvious. Do you know Kata Bugazale?
Oh, is she the YouTuber that's in Illinois? Yeah. I came across her.
Yeah, so she's a friend, a very cool person. And she jumped on a stream with me the day after the election. And I asked her, you know, and she's someone that's more plugged into the Washington scene and party politics and stuff. And the first thing she said was like, every consultant that worked on that campaign should be fired and should never be able to work in politics again, which makes me think of like the thing you said. Walz comes out with all this steam. Everyone loves him. And then they just make him, for lack of a better term, shut the fuck up. And he doesn't get to be the charming Midwestern dad type he was. And I remember with Walz, I've said this story before, but the week before they picked him, I was visiting family in Minnesota. I've spent like a chunk of time in Minnesota every summer of my life, basically. And my not radically progressive, very just like normal salt of the earth Minnesota family, they were just like, we hope it's him. He's the best. And that stood out to me that like people in Minnesota just like, and you know, some of my family there, they come from a long line of teachers. They just like this guy because he seems like a normal dude. He can appeal to farmers. He can appeal to teachers. He can appeal to, you know, weird city dwelling artist types as well. And a lot of the ways he articulates stuff like, hey, maybe kids should get to eat at school. Hey, maybe people should get to he just phrases stuff like that. So I like that. The other person I sneaky like, and it's wild that I like this person because they're a billionaire, but I have a soft spot for Pritzker.
JB. Yeah, I knew you were going to say it. Yeah, he's also somebody who kind of just, you could tell his filter is not really there like some of the other politicians. Yeah. Like even AOC, who I think is another exciting possibility, I think she just needs to unleash it. She kind of holds back, I think, a little bit. Also, she's extremely intelligent, and I think that actually works against her. We need somebody who just speaks like a seventh grader, who uses just common language. That's why Trump was so successful. Trump won a big I mean, going back to 2016, we think of him now, but when you go back and watch clips of him in 2015, 2016, he was authentic. He said things that other people were terrified to say. And you said fire the consultants of, fire all consultants. We don't need any consultants. We are in the post-consultant era. We don't need authenticity. I firmly believe this. It rules now. Because we all are on TikTok or YouTube and we have these,
a person.
You just being yourself is the reason why I've grown to like you in our parasocial relationship over the years.
Amazing.
Like,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, because you're not a lot of times you, I don't know how you do your format your videos, but do you have do you prefer an outline or do you actually script everything out?
I go back and forth. I sometimes will do a full script and then I'll occasionally have like in the script a little note to myself that's like, maybe talk about this, maybe think about that. And then other times when filming, it's almost like if I feel a tangent coming, I let myself do it, knowing that I can always, cut it later. but there is, as someone who, spent a lot of time teaching, and then I used to do improv comedy a lot, sometimes I like to trust myself if there's something that wasn't in the script that feels good. I mean, what do you fully script?
Mostly, yeah, but I do the same thing. Well, sometimes I'll go on a tangent, but I write out my vocal fillers. I try to write my scripts as if I'm talking. Mm-hmm. And I mean, imagine if we were like PBS right now where we just were relying on everything scripted. And I mean, sure, you've maybe got questions written down, but it's very informal. I mean, people are okay with this. Most people that are watching right now in the chat, they're doing something else right now.
Yeah.
So it's just the age we live in. And these boomers who have not figured it out yet, we stop with the scripts. Kamala Harris, her scripted answers were so cringy.
Yeah, we've all seen better. And I think and again, not to just blow smoke here, but something I thought was really interesting in Kat's campaign is one of the first things I said they were doing is all the money we fundraise, we're not going to use it to pay consultants. We're not going to use it to buy ads. We're going to do stuff in our community. So she's already using campaign funds to put money back into the community in which she's running. One of the first things they did, I think, was her first campaign event. You didn't have to pay to get into it, but they were asking for donations of tampons or women's hygiene products to go towards a project in Chicago that donates for women in need. And it's one of those things that she does that and it feels so radical, but in another sense, it shouldn't. It shouldn't be crazy that the people who want us to vote for them to serve our communities in their campaign show us that that's what they want to do. So I think and it was really cool. I got to sit in on Kat's, some of her, she's been doing virtual office hours, and I sat in for a bit last week. And there's one person who called in is a young dude in Pennsylvania who's 26, and one of the local congressperson in his district has been letting him down. So his friends kind of jokingly got him to register. And I do think there's a lot of real people who are going to run soon. And I think that's a really good thing.
What district is she running for?
I think, is it the eighth district in Illinois? I might have, it's eighth or ninth.
Ninth is what it pops.
Yeah.
Up. Okay. Yeah. So is that Chicago area?
Yeah, it's the north, a chunk of the north side of the city proper. And then the north suburbs.
Okay.
So I think it's Evanston is in that area.
Yep.
Yeah. Cause wait, you live in Kansas, right?
Yeah. Just west of Kansas City.
Oh, nice. Kansas City is a place that, cause I live in LA, and especially any person not from here, we're constantly just looking at houses and neighborhoods in the Midwest. At least my wife and I are.
Yeah.
So sometimes we have tastes one night. Well, we virtually live in Kansas City. The next day I'm in Grand Rapids. We're always bouncing
around.
Grand
Rapids is nice too. They got some good breweries there.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I'm getting to do. This is way too just personal shooting the shit stuff. But yeah, we're spending a couple weeks at a family member's place in Michigan this summer. And I'm just so excited to cosplay as a rural Midwesterner for a couple weeks and hopefully convince my wife that maybe we need to just do that. Cause that's the joy, I guess, at least the thing I think about of if I can make it work going full time on YouTube is you can live wherever you live and do it. We got a few minutes of your time. I want to talk about one thing that's really important to me, which, and this is an embarrassing confession, I did not know about your second channel, Beat Goes On, until very recently. I would say that until very recently, and it like kind of blew me away, because you make a lot of stuff and you make a lot of good stuff. But I'm someone, I know that you're a musician and you've done music for your videos. I know you're in a band and stuff like that. But I'm also a music guy, love music, like playing music, all sort of stuff. So to know that you have an entire other channel where you make really good videos about music you presumably like a lot. And the thing that I like about it the most is, and hopefully this isn't like offensive to say, is like, you know, the views on your second channel all over the place. Some of these things have popped off. Some of them have stayed pretty mellow, but it indicates to me that you just really love doing this stuff. And you have and that's why, like, watching those videos, like, I mean, the first one I watched, obviously, is the newest one when I saw the channel, is the Outkast one. I'm also a big Outkast guy.
Nice.
You got a lot going on in the main channel. You have a ton of stuff you're doing. What is it about? I know you talk about stuff besides music there. What is it about music where you also have to make that stuff?
Yeah, I got the idea to start this second channel when I was trying to tell my daughters about these great bands they should listen to. Uh-huh. Of course, they didn't listen to me. So I was like, fine, I'll just tell the internet. And of course, it's like in my style of as if I'm a teacher. Like, I use PowerPoint like a lot for my videos and I screencast all of it. And so, yeah, it has that educational feel. Like, these videos are meant for youngins mostly who have never heard of these bands. The first one I ever made was about Radiohead, and that's my favorite band. Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
You like Radiohead?
We separated at birth or something. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Well, no wonder we like each other. this is just a quick story. I love Radiohead so much that we were in Oxford a couple years ago. I had the whole family with me, and I forced them to walk a couple miles so we could go to the bar, the dive bar where Radiohead played their first official gig. It's just so I could get a picture. And they were complaining the whole time. My oldest daughter, she's like, why are we here? I'm tired. You know, I want to go to bed. And then flash forward a year later, and I catch her listening to Kid A. And yes. And she's like, oh, have you heard of Radiohead? Have I heard of Radiohead? Like, we, and then, no, get this. She goes out recently and buys a CD of the Bends. And she came home, like, from the record store, like, you're buying CD. I guess kids buy CDs now. And so, like, I ran to my, I ran to my room, ran out. And we had the exact same CD still, like, side by side. I had a picture. It was a very proud dad moment. But yeah, I make those videos for the youngins mostly.
That's amazing.
Also for films. By the way, Patsy Cline, kids got to know about Patsy Cline. That video, speaking of videos, I did not make for the views. I knew that video would tank. Check out Patsy Cline.
Everyone go watch that one. I'm gonna try to remember to link to that in the description here. So I'll go later. But that's great parenting motivation too. I have a very young daughter who is just about two. So it's fun listening to music with her. I'm getting ready. You know, I know at some point there's going to be the age where everything I like is dumb and bad.
Right.
And hopefully she'll discover good stuff on her own. But yeah, I mean, Radiohead's a thing where you just got to give them time. Did you listen to the Dissect podcast season they did on In Rainbows?
No, I have not.
You got a lot going on. You got a big media diet, I'm sure. As a Radiohead fan, it's one of my favorite things. And it's, you know, it's the podcast does like they did an episode for every song in Rainbows. And as a musician, I think you definitely like this. Because I remember like the Weird Fishes episode. It's like they literally break down every part. It's like, okay, here Tom's doing an arpeggio of this like E major 7 thing. But then when Johnny comes in, he's doing, you know, he's playing at a different syncopated rhythm on top. All this sort of shit. It's so cool. And they got the stem tracks for it. So they literally break the songs apart. I don't know. If anyone's watched it, if you're a nerdy music fan and you like Radiohead, I cannot recommend that enough. I will let you get going. Can I ask you just as a tease for folks what you're working on these days or what we might see from you coming out in the coming months or whatever?
My next video comes out on Friday.
Oh, it's, there we go.
It's about the Korean War. I got a Got pictures of my grandpa in the Korean War that I'm going to feature in it. We just had it right here. Yeah, isn't that cool? My dad gave these to me, and I was like, might as well incorporate that into the story, because that's how he like lost his hearing, was in that war. And he never really talked about it when he was alive, but it's been fun to research all that. So I'm excited to release it.
Yeah. And someone in the chat asked, it's the Dissect podcast for Radiohead is the one that I referenced there. Amazing. Well, guys, I'll stick around for a few and shoot the shit with you, but we're going to let Matt, AKA the Mr. Beast, get back to his life. So thank you so much for hanging out, Matt. Hopefully we can chat again at some point and keep in touch. Really, really, really great to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
See you soon.
All right. Bye.
And shout out to everyone in the Mr. Beat community that popped into this one. Guys, really appreciate you all for being here. Okay, guys. So we'll hang out for a little bit. I think I'm going to stream as well on Wednesday this week, so I don't want to go too far. I did see someone bring up in the chat, I think it was Troy Walker, and I think you're bringing up the Weird Fishes cover by that really good artist whose name that I cannot remember right now. Is it like Marie LaHavis or something like that? Let's see if I can find it. Yeah. Oh, Lillian LaHavis or Lillian LaHavas. I don't know. I think it's like a Greek last name. But yeah, she has a cover of Weird Fishes on her album. That's incredibly good. So there you go. I did not make a Giz reference. If someone did, it was not me. But seriously, thanks again to Mr. Beat, Matt, for coming on a YouTube channel. I like a lot. And I think, you know, a great thing about his channel, and as we saw him as a person, is not being so ideologically wedded that he can't explore a bunch of different ideas and consider stuff from a bunch of different perspectives. And I think that's something that you know, I aspire to. So there you go. You know, there's some stuff I was thinking of looking into. I saw an article today about how 23andMe sold the genetic data of 15 million people for $256 million to a pharmaceutical company called Regeneron. And that stuff's always pretty crazy, you know, right? When like our data just gets sold. Let's see if I can make it pop up on screen. You guys remember last week when I couldn't make anything work? This is the article I was thinking of right there. We don't have to read the whole thing, but that's just where we're at, guys. That's where we're at, you know. Monday, the genetic pharmaceutical company Regeneron announced that it is buying genetic sequencing company 23andMe out of bankruptcy for $25.6 million. The current monetary value of a single person genetic data is 17. So if you do need $17, it's important to know that that is what your genes are worth. And I figured that's something you would all want to know. So now you know that that is the case. Someone said Mr. Beat is slowly becoming Mr. Based. I think that's true. A couple update things on my end and we'll get going. I'm going to stream again Wednesday this week. I might have a guest Wednesday. I'm not 100% sure yet. Do check out my most recent video if you haven't. It kind of did the YouTube thing where it started really strong and then completely tanked, and it's fine. It is what it is. The game is the game. But check that out if you haven't. It's on depression, mental health, capitalism, how these things all interact. There's a world, we'll see if it happens, where I might be doing some streaming, and it might be over on his channel tomorrow with FD Signifier. So I will shoot you guys a message. If you do not, and this is not going to be solely a money pitch here, to be clear, if you do not subscribe to my Patreon, think about doing it on the free level. And the reason I say that is because that's where I always update if I'm streaming, if stuff's coming out, if I'm doing other things. So check that out if you want. And then I'll let you know there for sure if I end up streaming with FD Signifier tomorrow. It's supposed to happen. We've been kind of playing a game of phone tag, trying to get together and chat. So that might happen. Wednesday, I should be streaming here like normal. There's a world. Let me see if this got confirmed while we were talking. Okay. Wednesday, I'm going to stream with Taylor Lorenz. You guys know who that is? You know Taylor Lorenz? Writer, makes YouTube videos and does podcast stuff. So Taylor Lorenz is going to be on the show on Wednesday. She put out a video today that I really want to check out. If there was a point where I was like, if I hang out for longer today, maybe I'll watch this, but I won't. But she put out a video on the somebody needs to do it meme. So Taylor's going to be here Wednesday. So that should be pretty fun. I'm excited for that. YouTube watcher said, do you know of the YouTuber Dr. Fatima? She's an awesome physicist. I emailed Dr. Fatima yesterday and asked if she wanted to come on the show sometimes. CJ, the ex, put me onto her work, and I think is really awesome. Would love to chat with her some more. And, you know, as I'm going to do a thing at the end of every stream now where I do my what's been going on in terms of making this channel my job or doing stuff. Thumbnails. I'm getting stressed about thumbnails. I've been making them myself. I know they're not very good. What kind of happens, I think, is that I put a video out and I make a thumbnail and it helps out, or it does well with you guys or people that know me. You see it and you're like, oh, cool. That's great. Please like the stream. Noah's, yeah, I'll put a link to Noah's thing before we leave. I know he's doing a fundraiser stream and that's really cool. But I think what happens is like you guys click my thumbnails, but then what has happened is when YouTube shows my video to like more people, they're sort of like, who the fuck is this guy? So I think that maybe that's what's happening. So if anyone does know a thumbnail person, you know, hit me up. Someone said if they kiss my glorious dome. Oh, yeah. Well, you know. Oh, and let me as well. I don't, you know, who knows who watches stuff or when or how they watch it. Sorry, I was about to share something with you guys. Where did it go? I don't know. I can't remember anything. But I do want to say shout out if they watch this to I think it was Esteban and Laura. And what was the dog's name? Hermes that I met at a bar the other night. I met some people that watched the show the other night, and it was very cool to meet them. It's amazingly cool to meet people in life who watch the videos and stuff like that. If you ever see me in life, please say hi. I promise that I'm pretty nice. People are saying make weirder faces in thumbnails. Let's see. Close up of your bald head. Oh yeah, maybe I'll do raw dome for the next thumb. Do we think that would help, guys? If I do that, make a dumb face and bug your eyes out. Can you stream with JT Chapman? I don't know JT, but I could talk to him. Leviathan, thank you. I'm glad you liked the editing on that one. But yeah, so we'll see. But I'm not worried about that. But I'm trying to make thumbs better. That's the thing I'm thinking about. Let's see. If you make thumbnails for cheap, you can email me michaeloneilburns@gmail.com. It's on my friggin' page. If you go to the about me thing or whatever, you got to say you're not a robot. You got to say you're not a robot. If you're a robot, you better not fucking email me. But it's right there. Bailey, I've watched Slugs. I'm obsessed with Slugs. I love Slugs. They're my favorite. Okay, so. Everyone go check this out then. Noah Samson's doing a stream and they're raising money for, I think, Palestine. Go hit the chat. Let's like leave here, flood that. Say that I sent you or something like that. Why not? Check out my most recent video if you haven't. Sign up for Patreon and stuff like that. Because hey, wouldn't it be cool if I didn't have patrons where I didn't have to worry about ads? That would be a cool thing I'm looking for at some point. What else? Streaming Wednesday. I'm going to stream with Taylor Lorenz. I think I'm going to do it around noon my time. We'll see you there. We'll hang out. No other videos coming soon. Thank you so much again to Matt from Mr. Beat for coming around. That was really, really cool. I really enjoyed that conversation. Hope you guys did as well. Stay safe. Have a great week. I really appreciate you. And again, I won't say I love you because someone got mad at me for saying I love you. So if you need love from me, know that someone saying that I couldn't say I love you took that love from you. The love's coming from me. I want to give it to you. But someone said I can't say it because it feels inauthentic. And I get it. We live in a world where we're caught up parasociality. You know, am I telling you I love you because I really love you and I really care about you? Or am I telling you I love you because I want you to sign up, like, subscribe? You know, is it all fake? Is this who I am? Is this who I really am? I think it's who I really am, but maybe it's not, because maybe capitalism is so deep in my fucking brain that I think this is who I am, but it's not who I am. And I'm being controlled by some algorithmic impulse to produce, to accumulate, to acquire. I don't know. I just know that I like you. I know that it means a lot. I like seeing your names in the chat. Those of you who I know, those of you who I don't know, I really enjoy doing this. It makes me happy. And I feel way more connected to my labor doing this and doing it myself than I did working for a company. And that means a lot to me. So thank you so much for being here. Appreciate you guys so much. Appreciate you so much. I'm not going to get one guide. You know what? You know what?